This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. Silver Bullet has been running for 4 years now, and this is the 48th in a series of interviews with security gurus. I'm super pleased to have with me today Andy Jaquith. Hi, Andy.
Hey there, Gary. Although, you know, with all these security gurus on, I don't know why you wanted to have me on.
I forgot I was going to call you Andrew, too, so big trouble there. Andrew Jaquith, who I call Andy, is a senior analyst at Forrester, where he covers data leak prevention, crypto, server virtualization, and software security. Andy's been in security for 15 years. In prior jobs, he's been a program manager for the Yankee Group and a consultant for At Stake. He also worked at Cambridge Technology Partners and FedEx. Andy's the author of Security Metrics and is very active in Metricon and other research conferences. Andrew has a BA in economics and political science from Yale, and he lives in Boston with his family. You've been in commercial computer security for 15 years. That's about the same number of years as me. What do you think are the biggest changes you've seen in security and how it's practiced?
Well, I think the single biggest change has probably been the overrunning of security by compliance. It's the mugging of the security guy by the auditors, I guess. And I think that's the biggest thing. It's really, you know, we've done some data work here at Forrester looking at how companies spend their money, and we figure probably around 40% of company budgets are spent on actual security, and another 40% is spent on compliance-oriented projects, which is something you would not have seen 10 years ago. I think when I was at At Stake, we did a handy business doing application security assessments of different types. We competed against you somewhat, Gary. But we always shied away from the compliance stuff. You know, we stayed away from what later became PCI. We stayed away from like ISO assessments, partly because they were deathly dull, mm-hmm. but partly because we had this idea that that compliance had really nothing to do with security. So why would we bother? Now the links are maybe slightly tighter, you can argue, but still there is this disconnect between being compliant with a particular mandate, whether it be one of the ones I mentioned or some others, and whether you're actually secure. And if you need any further proof of this, all you need to do is look in the federal space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really an interesting concept that you raised there. The question is, do you think that compliance driver is growing or shrinking just right now? I know it's grown over the years, over the last 10 years, a ton, and I completely agree with that. But my perception is it's beginning to shrink now as a driver. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, compliance shrinkage, huh, as a phenomenon. I think maybe. I mean, it's getting under control in certain areas. I mean, I think at this point, you know, for example, with PCI, there has been enough energy around that, and that regime has been around long enough that people have kind of figured out what they need to do, even if they're not always happy about it. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, the PCI Standards Council is ratcheting up the requirements. But at this point, there is this sense of, you know, we know what it is. We can sort of see where things are going to go, and we know what we need to do in the future. I think that there are some other areas where compliance pressures are increasing, and those tend to be around the circulation of PII, the stuff about people. And so you see this in some of the breach disclosure laws. That's been, you know, I've said this many times before, but, you know, personal information is a little like asbestos. We've been building our houses with it for years, and we've just discovered it. It's toxic when it's airborne. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's what's driven the Massachusetts law and the Rhode Island law and Nevada and so forth. And in a weird way, we're kind of backing into a EU-style data protection regime without completely realizing it. This is not necessarily a bad thing. We're just getting into it in completely the wrong way. But that's definitely something. I mean, I talk to customers all the time who want to know, you know, what does it mean? Do I have to encrypt, you know, my PDAs? Do I have to buy encryption software for my smartphones? I mean, you know, there's a lot of overreactions, this kind of stuff. But it's all around this fear of spilling, you know, spilling data that you're expected to be a good custodian of.
Mm-hmm. So the at-stake cabal that you mentioned before is quite big. There are a lot of people who were employed by at-stake that have gone on to do great things in security. I think you guys have been changing the field in interesting ways. And now that Mudge is at DARPA, you know, that's pretty cool too. The question I have for you is, what are the biggest challenges remaining, and how's the at-stake cabal going to help us get those challenges dealt with properly?
The at-stake cabal. There's a whole, as you know, there's a whole bunch of folks there. Like NeoHapsis is being run by James Mobley, and there's a whole at-stake group there. There's ISEC Partners on the West Coast. There's Leviathan. There's a bunch of small consultancies here in the Boston area, like Rob Sheen, Safe Flight Advisors. And, I refer to this in general as at-stake reanimated, you know, and I mean this in the sense of like...
I think cabal's a better term.
It's like the little hand scuttling around in the Addams Family, you know. But it's pretty cool, and it was a great place to be from. I think the alumni continue to shape the industry in a lot of ways. You got Brad Arkin over at Adobe. I mean, Wendell Snyder.
Oh, he's one of my proteges.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. So he's got a shared parentage. Then what can we say? Right? So, but the list goes on, and it's nice to see, you know, people that were kind of solid and kind of doing it back in the day that are having an influence. And, you know, you mentioned Mudge at DARPA. I mean, that's a great example. And then you got people who moved on to do some other interesting things, like Joe Grant, who was a hardware hacker and now has his own industrial design studio. Mm-hmm. So it's a great group. So yeah. I think I totally dodged your question, and I just reminisced instead. So I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. I'm not going to let you dodge it, though. So the biggest challenges remaining for computer security, given, you know, the fact that you've been working on it for 15 years and you've seen all these changes, what have we not done?
I think the biggest thing we haven't figured out is user design when it comes to security.
Oh, yeah. I think you're right about that.
I think we haven't figured out that there are choices that we make when we design our environments. This is sort of back to Ross Anderson's security is hard thing. I almost feel you could put that in like one of these wind-up Barbie dolls. You know, you pull the string and she says, security is hard. But Ross said it best in that security engineering is hard, and I think that's right. We don't pay enough attention to defaults. Mm-hmm. About the choices that users make by default. And, you know, my classic example was has been and continues to be Internet Explorer, you know, something that has ActiveX and browser helper objects. I mean, you know, remotely triggered local C code, mm-hmm. I guess is the best way to put it. And this can't be a good recipe. And it explains some of what we've seen in terms of browser issues.
Right.
Not everything, of course, but it's just, you know, if that stuff wasn't there, would we have that particular class of problem? The answer is we wouldn't. If we didn't, if we were more aggressive about using things like terminal services and Citrix and centralizing a lot of our data that's toxic, would we need as many, would we need to buy all this aftermarket stuff for encrypting hard drives on laptops? Maybe we wouldn't, you know. So there's a whole bunch of ways you can go about this. I think the key, though, is that it comes down to user experience, really, really, really understanding what makes for a good secure experience and making sure that's baked into the environment by default rather than having to go through all these hoops, asking the user to think, you know, recognizing that they're always going to make the wrong choice when you ask them to do that.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer. So the rise of social networking software like Twitter, and I know you're an active Twitterer at ARJ, and Facebook is causing some tension between the Gen Y people and the silverbacks that are running security in large enterprises. So who wins?
Ultimately, Gen Y wins because the silverbacks, as you put it, will all die or they'll retire.
Gosh, we have to wait that long?
Maybe, I mean, it could take that long, but the thing of it is, you know, we've done some survey work on this, and you know, I had a question from a European bank about this, and they said how many other financial services firms like ours, and they happen to be in one of these combination investment and merchant banks. Mm-hmm. How many banks like us actually allow social networking? And so I said, I don't really know off the top of my head, and I looked into our data, and we figured that probably about a third of them do. Mm-hmm. And another third or thereabouts is expecting to increase their usage of social networking tools in the next 12 months. What does that mean? It means that even in places that have some of the most stringent security requirements, there's huge pressures to use social networking tools of different types, be it LinkedIn or Facebook, and it usually starts as the thin end of a wedge, right, on with the marketing team, because they want to get their brand out there, they want to connect to younger consumers, or they, you know, they want to spread their influence and so forth, and so that's where it starts. Where it tends to go after that is you have more general purpose business users who see a good reason to use this. Mm-hmm. I mean, LinkedIn in many ways is almost sort of like a federated directory.
You know, right.
I'm sure the folks at Microsoft would cringe if they heard me say that. But it's almost ADFS minus the crypto and the trust and all the other stuff that makes ADFS good, you know. But it is a distributed directory, and I think that's what people use it for. That's how they find a lot of people these days.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that reason, you know, it's a little like virtualization. The economics and the easy use are too good not to use it, and so people will. And so the real question, as usual in the security profession, is how do you essentially how do you clean up after the elephant?
Right.
So what do you do now that you're in this situation?
I think it's
the answer, of course, is to get out ahead of it.
Oh, I think it's just a current topic that a lot of security professionals could be, you know, spending some time thinking about, so that we don't just become seen as the naysayers again, as usual.
Right.
So I can't really afford $499 to buy your 2010 data security predictions paper. And instead, I want to know what your number one prediction is for free.
All right. Well, fair enough, Gary. I think the big prediction, and this has not gone down too well with some of the vendors, is that this whole category of data leak prevention software, which is something that I cover pretty closely,
yep,
is going to get cheaper. And the reason it's going to get cheaper is because expectations are going to be a little bit deflated.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't a full cancer-curing, globe-spanning piece of software that is going to do everything, auto-classify, protect, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it does plenty of that stuff. But the use case tends to be optimized around the PII cases, the
right,
toxic data stuff, you know, the credit cards, social security numbers, and the like. And that is what about two-thirds or so, three-quarters of the customers that we talk to are using it for.
Mm-hmm.
And once you say, aha, we found a really good optimized use case, you can start to really commoditize it. And so that's the other factor that's going into it, is we're predicting the emergence of a category that we call DLP Express.
Mm-hmm.
And Gary, as an old apps guy, you'll appreciate this, but the difference between DLP Express and Enterprise DLP is like the difference between WebLogic and WebLogic Enterprise. Right? It's a cut down, much more cut down piece of functionality. In this case, you know, all it's going to do is PII and credit cards and you know, medical record numbers and things like that.
Yeah.
It's not going to make grandiose claims about protecting your intellectual property and keeping, you know, the advanced persistent Chinese from getting your documents and all that stuff.
Right.
It's going to be really limited to just that particular problem space. And it's going to be a lot cheaper. It's probably going to make its way into endpoint products and the like. And there's three or four vendors that are working actively on introducing products, which means that instead of paying, you know, $100 a seat or $75 a seat or $200 a seat for this stuff, you're going to be paying 30 or 40,
right,
or 20.
I think, you know, that's
and this is all goodness.
I think that's a really interesting prediction. I like that one a lot. Kind of a question about technology in that space. Is it okay to root all of your own clients at the endpoints to protect data?
Great question. The bigger question, right, is it okay to essentially spy on your employees in order to keep them safe?
Sure.
Right? I mean, that's the bigger issue.
Yeah. But what do you think?
You know, as a consequence of doing that, you have to root the client. You know, Dan Gere, who is still CS. You know, we both know Dan well, but
yep,
but he's a chief scientist emeritus at Vertices. He completely unapologetically describes the software that they sell as a rootkit.
Yep, I know.
Yeah.
About the at-stake cabal. Dan's one of those too. So
I know.
So the question is, you know, whether or not, what do you think? Is that good? Is it okay to do that?
I think it's okay. I think there are situations where you absolutely have to do it. The specialties required to do that mean that by definition you're pretty much going to optimize for one platform, that is to say a Windows client.
Right.
And you have to assume that those devices are yours. So if those two assumptions hold, that all the devices you need to monitor are yours and it's going to be a Windows client, then cool. But if that assumption doesn't hold for various reasons, like you've got an offshore development partner, and you don't manage those devices,
or everybody has a cell phone,
or everybody's got a cell phone, right? So there's going to be areas where you can't do that. And so the as always, the answer is you've got to have overlapping controls around this. You need to have a network component, as well as if endpoint is really what you're concerned about, you need to have an endpoint component too.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back after this message. Hi, this is Gary McGraw, host of the Reality Check podcast with Gary McGraw. This podcast series is focused on practical questions centered on running large-scale software security initiatives. Reality Check targets experienced leaders working to solve software security problems every day. Reality Check is sponsored by Sigital and syndicated by CSO Magazine. For more, see www.sigital.com/realitycheck. Switching gears a little bit. So you've been very active in leading the metrics community, and we all thank you for that. I really love your book, Security Metrics. But I also find it a little unsatisfying because it leads you right up to the edge where the view is really very nice view, but it doesn't sort of jump off the edge with a big parachute on. And so the question is, when's the next book coming?
It's a good question, Gary. I got no good answer for it. I will agree with you though on one point.
I'm trying to pin you down into saying you're going to write another book. Come on.
I have another book in me. I'm not sure it's going to be about metrics. What I will say though is that I'm continuing to work with Forrester customers, and we are writing research about it and holding workshops, and so there's plenty happening.
Yep.
Whether it makes its way into a book or a pamphlet or a research report, it's hard to tell at this point. I have gotten a lot of requests for it though.
Well, let me go on the record saying we really want another book out of you, because that first one was great. It was very helpful.
My colleague Khalid Kark has been looking to do one as well. So oh. I may contribute to that as well. There's a lot of different ways to do this.
Cool. So
I'm not going to let you pin me down.
Well, let the record show that you said there is one in there. So in my own work, I've retreated, as you know, from attempts to measure first order effects like maybe bugs per square inch to second-order measurement of activities, and you could call this maybe the BCM retreat. Is the BCM retreat our only hope, or can we actually find some first-order measurements that'll work?
I think ultimately when you get to, I mean, here's the thing. With these first-order measurements, they're empirical. You can't argue with them. They're cheap to gather and so forth, but mm-hmm. but ultimately, if you're going to put together some numbers that mean something to the boss, you probably do, by definition, need a second-order metric. And maybe, Gary, you could just give the audience a sense of, I mean, you and I have talked about this privately, but maybe not on the podcast. Give the folks what you mean by a second-order measure.
Well, so the notion of what sort of activities you do in your software security initiative, one example would be buy and use a static analysis tool. That doesn't really have anything to say about whether the software you produce is any better per se. You're kind of hoping that it will be, but it's not measuring the software. It's only measuring the fact that you went out and bought and used one of those tools. So, second order. And the question is, geez, is collecting up these second order things, first of all, is that useful? I think that it is, but it does really not get to the heart of the problem. I just wonder whether you can get to the heart of the problem.
I think it's definitely helpful. There's no question about it, because you're measuring, in many ways, I think we all know that software is a process game, right? So there's an element of what's your process control, mm-hmm. like, it's like any kind of process manufacturing industry. Mm-hmm. And if you can measure the inputs, then you indirectly can predict what the outputs are going to be. The outputs are harder to measure, so I think you can measure the inputs a little bit better.
Well, let's get to that question through your own field, so the data leak protection stuff. Do you think that measuring data breaches themselves does any good? Because it sort of reminds me of collecting up the red dyed cash after a bank robbery happens. That it answers where the red dyed cash got to, but it doesn't really say anything often about how the robbery occurred.
Yeah, I think you can measure some things around data leaks. Right now, we're all looking at course measures. I mean, if you look at things like the data loss database, for example, data loss DB, which I think is a great source of information, and I try and pimp those guys whenever I can because I think they're doing fantastic work.
Yeah, me too.
You know, what do they get you? Well, they get you a sense of scale of how often it happens, of what some of the causes are. They're working on some cost figures to try and estimate what it's going to cost per record and things like that. So you can get some indirect measure of loss on it in a way that is better than your annualized loss expectancy type thing, which mm-hmm. is an estimate of what might happen. Mm-hmm. Here you've actually got numbers on what did happen. So I think it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I answered your question, though.
Well, I think you did. I agree with you that it has its utility, and it's probably important that we collect it. But as you know, my big bugaboo is how do these things happen, and what do we fix to make them not happen? I guess the first order thing that you have to convince people of is that it is, in fact, happening. So, you know, those of us that have been doing this for a long time, well, we know that already. But there are a lot of people that don't. So I guess that measurement really helps those guys come along.
Yeah, people don't patch the roof until it rains. I mean, that expression has happened many. You've heard that many times before, and so you need evidence that it's actually raining out in order to do this.
Right.
I also think though that what you have from the data loss guys is part of it, and then the other part of it is some of the almost the root cause type things, which are a lot more craft brewing, I guess I would say. And that's things like the Verizon report, you know, which is I'm sure you've talked to Wade and the other guys over there mm-hmm. on these podcasts. But they're great. They give you a real sense of what happened and how somebody got in. And you know, you need to look at that. You need to look at folks like the Mandiant folks. They're doing some of their own reports.
Mm-hmm.
This really gives you a sense of what the key methods are. So you at least get some insight in terms of how the robbers got in, how the red dyed cash actually got where it went to.
Right, right. Okay,
so together you get a real sense of it.
Sure. So who won the battle of the brains between you and Showstack? Who, by the way, was Silver Bullet Victim 26 way back almost 2 years ago?
I don't think there was really a winner. It was Adam and I basically got together to do a very informal podcast. And we had a really good time.
You mean the cover was
better.
Misleading?
It was misleading because it wasn't more of a battle. It was more like a, you know, coffee chat of the brains or something. And that's a lot less controversial than battle. So we really didn't battle about too much.
So I really love the thing that you did to the lifestyle hacking article in CSO. Because, you know, after we had breakfast the other day, I went over there and you got me back almost within, I don't know, 4 hours. That's pretty good.
Oh, which one?
Derek took your picture and stuck it in the lifestyle hacking issue. And said that you said to say that you were watching me after I punked you. He, you know, he did it, right?
I didn't know he did that. I did not know that.
It was very nice.
I definitely, he must really be watching my tweets then, because I think I tweeted it. That's what happened.
Yes, that's right. He did, in fact. And so he didn't even tell you. Wow, you got your minions are doing your bidding without even being ordered around.
Well, I actually feel bad because I also sent out a tweet the other day that said the editors at CSO should be shot for allowing.
I saw that.
How data exfiltration, how data gets out.
Right.
And my comment was, data does not do this by itself.
That's right. Data is not an animate object.
Yeah.
So one other topic real quick. So at Cigital, we work with all sorts of tools vendors in the software security space and almost all the static analysis vendors like Fortify and Ounce and Coverity and Clockworks and everybody else. So what are the pros and cons of static analysis in your view? I know you've covered that space pretty extensively.
Yeah. Well, some of my thinking, frankly, has been influenced by some of the things you've said, right? So I'm tempted to use the word badnessometer here, but I shall resist. You know, what do you get out of static analysis? You get a sense of where the tools have found potential flaws. But like anything else, you've got to actually look through it and to see if it makes sense. I mean, my feeling is that the tools have come a long way. They've gotten a lot better tuned than they used to be. But they're only one part of a healthy, balanced diet that controls. So they're part of measuring the quality of the stuff that goes into the code. But there's also issues of looking at it from the outside, you know, penetration testing, the initial strategy, right? So it, you can, let me put it this way. When you run one of these tools, this is on code that exists.
Mm-hmm.
In order for that code to exist, you would have had to design it and come up with a plan for it. And in order to do that, you would have had to be thinking initially about what your security strategy needs to be and what your architecture needs to be. If you've done a bad job at those things,
yep.
then you know the code is only going to reflect some of those choices. It's you can't really run a scan on an architecture.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So there's an element of human review that is always going to come into it. And so when we look at, you know, looping this back to metrics, for example, one of the metrics that that I've advocated quite a bit is that you need to be measuring what percentage of the time your security team has a consultation with your app developer groups mm-hmm. when they are embarking on an application.
Right.
Because
well, as you know, that's what the BSIM tries to get to the bottom of.
Yeah, exactly. So exactly, one of these key process metrics of, you know, just the fact that it happened is useful because you're always going to produce a better design when you talk to people outside your frame of reference that, you know, are also paranoid and are thinking about security and maybe think about things that maybe you didn't think about when you're putting your app together.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're part of the diet. I think they're part of the diet. I think they're valuable.
Uh-huh. So another piece of your work covers cryptography pretty extensively, and I just have a personal question. How do you crypt your own email?
I don't.
Goodness.
I don't.
Not at all. S/MIME's pretty easy. Have you tried that?
That's true. But the thing of I find chats with people who are advocating what they refer to as secure email to be really interesting. And by secure they mean encrypted.
Right.
And you know, I've had conversations with them that say, you know, don't you secure your email? And I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, how will people trust that it's from you? And they said, well, people always trust that it's from me.
Because it has your sparkling wit in it. It's like obvious.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, people assume this stuff is coming from you by default.
Right.
There are some exceptions around this, like with a bank. If you get an email from a bank, you assume it's not from them these days.
Exactly, because phishing has ruined email from banks,
yeah.
basically.
But those are one of the – that's maybe the exception. So long answer to your question, I actually don't. I mean, I have in cases, right? I'm a developer for Apache, so, you know, there are cases where you need to sign things in order to make sure that the code – has some integrity and all that stuff.
Right.
But that's different than just my normal data.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I used to have the same answer, but I've found that a lot of people are using S/MIME these days and me too, and it's just really easy. So I don't know. Check that out. See if you think it's useful.
I probably should. I mean, the question is whether I do it in my personal email or I do it in my work. I could do it in work email easily enough, but my personal email is mostly Gmail.
Yeah. Right. Right.
You can't really do that.
Right. That's true. So, and then the last question, you know, which is always a crazy question, what is your favorite piece of new music or music that you've just obtained? It doesn't have to have been made recently, just obtained by you recently.
Oh, boy. Great question. I think the piece of music that I obtained recently that I kind of wanted and liked was Moby's Southside. But not the one that comes on the album, but the one with the Gwen Stefani mix.
Hmm.
And,
cool.
It's actually hard to get. You can't buy it anywhere, so I had to find a different method for getting it, shall we say.
We won't ask.
And it's, yeah, we won't. But it's they won't sell it to you. It's really kind of upsetting. I can't get it anywhere.
And it's only on the, I don't know. What did
on
my
the
kid,
interwebs.
On the interwebs.
Yeah. I don't normally do that. I mean, like 99.999% of my music is obtained.
Yeah.
The ways you would expect. But every now and then you got one thing that sticks in your head and you just got to have it.
Well, you know, you're slipping into Gen Y. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Andrew. It's been fun.
Okay, Gary. Well, this has always been fun. I look forward to hearing this edited or not, and I'm sure we'll catch up with you soon.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The March-April issue of IEEE S&P examines mobile security and reliability. What can be done to protect cell phones and PDAs and the data we all store on them? Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.